This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November the 30th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Creek DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Bloomington-based Cook Group is one of the largest employers in Indiana, and its division, Cook Medical, is one of the foundational firms in the state's medical device industry. Cook Medical manufactures a staggering number of products for our bodies, and its facilities would be welcomed with open arms in any community in the state. By the end of next year, it expects to open a $15 million, 40,000 square foot manufacturing plant near the corner of 38th Street and Sheridan Avenue on Indianapolis's east side. This is a troubled neighborhood with residents struggling with high unemployment and poverty. And in the same way that Cook manufactures products to aid the body in healing, it hopes that this manufacturing facility will have a therapeutic effect on the area, not just with the 100 jobs that it'll create for residents, but the wide array of health, housing, and educational services that will be provided for workers on site. Now, to be clear, Cook is the main driver of this project, but it recruited several partners with related expertise and dedication to aiding the neighborhood. Cook plans to invest $7 million to help build the facility, with a balance of the cost picked up by the Indianapolis Foundation and tax credits made available through the City of Indianapolis. Goodwill of Central and Southern Indiana will run the facility, which will make medical devices exclusively for Cook. Cook also has been working with the United Northeast Community Development Corporation to help pave the way for the project. To get a better sense of how these pieces fit together to help the area get back on its feet, I've invited two guests to discuss the project. Pete Yonkman, the president of Cook Group and Cook Medical, and Ashley Gervitz, the executive director of United Northeast Community Development Corp. Here's our conversation. I am pleased to welcome to the IBJ Podcast's virtual studio, Pete Yonkman, president of Cook Group and Cook Medical. Pete, thank you for making time for us this week.
Hi, Mason. It's good to hear you and see you, I guess, in this virtual world we're living in.
Also joining us is Ashley Gervitz, the executive director of United Northeast Community Development Corporation, which works to generate economic opportunity, improve health outcomes, and upgrade housing in northeastern Indianapolis. Ashley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mason.
So let me start with you, Ashley. Let's just take a look at the area around 38th and Sheridan Street. First, I'm curious, does that neighborhood have a name?
It is technically Sheridan Heights, but one of the overarching identifiers is our Devington community.
And just in general, how do you describe it?
Well, I love, first and foremost, our community. Everyone here loves it. So that's our always the first description of love. Mm-hmm. But if we look at our neighborhood as a whole, we have actually many long-term residents that have been here 30, 40 plus years. We also, within the area, have about 86% persons of color, primarily Black, and of which the community itself really began to get its thriving abilities formerly from many of the manufacturing jobs nearby the area. Now, often or not, when we think of our community, I'm often reminded during our neighborhood associations that our area, as far as what I'm going to describe it today, is not at all what the hearts of our residents feel. When manufacturing left, there unfortunately was an economic downturn. And it had actually began to perpetrate some of the socioeconomic deprivations that honestly has made our community be seen more in this negative light. And really, we are looking for any means of getting jobs. We have still a great connection of like long-term thriving individuals that are engaged. Also, from a geographical bit, located along East 38th, we are a great connector community. So if you're needing to get from the furthest part east of Indianapolis to the furthest part west, you're crossing into our area. We just have incredible assets, especially our people that are willing and ready to seek any thriving opportunity.
And when you say the statistics, I mean, they tell a certain story. I mean, do you have a sense of the unemployment and poverty rates in the neighborhood?
Alarmingly high. I know after a recent Savvy report, especially unveiling some of the impacts of COVID-19. Now, I don't want to provide the wrong number. However, I do know that the report did indicate that socioeconomically, we were the hardest hit neighborhood, also known as the historic suburb here within Indianapolis. So we really, from an economics lens, have really, really been impacted from the former manufacturing jobs that left our area.
So the IBJ, within the last couple of years, produced a series of stories about the Northeast Side. It was called One City, Worlds Apart. And one of the stories focused on the feelings within struggling communities for developers and investors who parachute in with projects or big ideas that they believe will improve the area, though sometimes improve is synonymous with gentrify. And as a result, there's a lot of distrust when large projects are proposed from outside the community.
Yes, yes, absolutely. When any developer or big picture is there, there's typically a missing link of being able to affirm the feel and sentiment from the resident itself. As a result, there is this kind of looming elephant in the room where we find that we're already predefined by all the negative and no one takes the time to see people in the assets that are there as a value. So things are often developed without the resident at the tables. Maybe a developer or someone with project interest may talk to a couple people from the community, but often or not, there's the sentiment where distrust is built with this over promise and under delivery.
Pete, what did Cook do to make sure that this was the right project for this area and make sure everybody could get on board?
The first best thing we did was meet Ashley. So we spent about, I don't know, we probably spent 3 or 4 days just meeting with community residents, community leaders, before we even knew where we were going, what the project should look like. We just wanted to hear from people what the, you know, we, like, you know, it's like everybody, you think you kind of know, but you don't until you really get a chance to meet people. And one of those meetings, we met Ashley. And what I would say was Ashley does a tremendous job being an advocate for a community, but it's not just being an advocate. What she did was she described the people of the community and she described all of the projects that are ongoing, all the connectivity that people have and the years of work that people have been putting in to build this neighborhood back. Then from there, she sort of opened the doors of the neighborhood to us. So she started to introduce us to the neighborhood presidents and to the, she introduced us to this great partnership, two young guys who are really trying to start a new grocery in the community. We met Michael and he was a young guy really working hard to bring quality food to an area that doesn't have it. And you know, you just see the passion and the dedication. And we were like, okay, that's where we want to be, right? We want to be with these folks. Because when you have partners like that, a project has a real opportunity to be successful. Ashley, you know, she talked a lot about, and the community talked a lot about it. We want to build with you. We don't want you to build on us. And I heard one resident explain it really well, this issue of gentrification, which was, you know, if you take the time and you look and you meet the people and all the work that's happening from the churches and from the mentoring centers and the grocery stores and the community centers, there's an unbelievable amount of work in history that's been there. And what this person said was, sometimes what it feels like is we've been doing all this work and somebody drops this giant alien ship down on top of our community and expects us to be happy about it. That really hit home for me of, I get it. We don't want to do that. We want to be partners with the community and really figure out how do we do this so it's a win-win for everybody.
How did you identify just that area to begin with?
We started this project, it's a relatively quick project. We started thinking about our opportunity here 4 months ago, and we knew we had an opportunity to expand. And, you know, we're a privately owned company. We make medical devices. We've been around since 1963. We're owned by a great family who's always been very community-minded. So we have a history of being deeply engaged in communities. And we said, okay, here's this job opportunity for 100 jobs. How could we make it more than that? And, you know, just where we're located, to be honest, we're located primarily out of Bloomington. We have a facility in Indianapolis and also in West Lafayette, Ireland, Denmark, Australia. We tend to be in a rural area, and we tend to be impacting with our community projects white communities. And we thought, you know, with all of this discussion about equity, and there's been a lot of great talk and a lot of great statements, and I make the joke that, you know, we're not a company that talks a lot, but we like to take action. And so we thought, okay, how do we really take action here? And so let's use this opportunity and try to make a, create a place for 100 jobs. But more than that, let's create an opportunity for free education for the employees. We partnered with Goodwill to be able to provide wraparound services for people who needed it. And then we engaged the Indianapolis Foundation because the community had said, you know, it's great, these opportunities, but could we have a sense of long-term ownership and partnership with this? So the Community Foundation stepped up and invested, the Indianapolis Foundation stepped up and invested $4 million on behalf of the community so that the proceeds and the long-term equity of this project will go back into the community. So, you know, the way I try to describe it is we're not trying to do philanthropy here. We're trying to do good, long-term, sustainable business that's good for everybody, including the community. You know, we really try to think about a way, is it possible to do good business and to do good in the community at the same time? And we think we found a model that enables us to do that.
You know, in terms of who gets hired, are you requiring that applicants live in a certain area nearby?
So, you know, the idea is we're not going to have a requirement, but what we're going to do is we're going to work with the community partners to identify people who live in that community to work there. Our goal for the creation of for the demolition and the building of the project, we want to use 100% minority-owned business and as local as possible. Same thing with the employees, all the way from the management to the entry-level positions. We want it to be minorities who have opportunities, but also as local as possible. It's why we chose the location. So if you look at 38th and Sheridan, it's in the heart of a neighborhood. And we wanted that. We wanted that feel of it's connected to the community. It's not just in some industrial park somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that's why we've been very, very intentional about how we chose location and how we set up the model.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how obviously you don't need to go to all this trouble to establish a 40,000 square foot manufacturing facility, which would be welcome like literally anywhere. Is it that much more complex to do what you're doing now? Or is this surprisingly more easy than you would expect?
You know, it's what I wish every owner and leader of a company could see. And that's why we hope they'll join us because it's so easy. A lot of times companies outsource projects. That's the nature of business. And they may be outsourced out of the country or to a different area. And it's hard. I've been through those processes. It's hard in long distances. But when you have a group like Goodwill, you have the community with Ashley, you have the residents who are looking for opportunity. They're passionate about it. It makes it so easy. We tried to create a model that other people could replicate because if other companies joined us, and not just in Black communities, but look at the rural communities that we have as well. We've had manufacturing jobs leave all across the state. And we've had communities that have declining populations. This model, if it's replicated, really could start to bring opportunity and hope back to these communities.
Is this something that you can create like a playbook for and you could just kind of pass on to whoever is interested?
Yep, we've done that. And so we have the structure and the playbook and the financials. We're happy to share that with anybody because we believe so strongly that it's a win-win for everybody that we hope everybody will do it.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Creek DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Creek DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Creek DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.creekdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're talking with Pete Yonkman and Ashley Gervitz about the $15 million manufacturing facility that Cook Medical is planning on the east side of Indianapolis to help stimulate the recovery of a struggling neighborhood.
So let me make sure I understand how these partnerships work. So this facility will not be owned by Cook Medical, but it will act as a supplier to Cook Medical. It will be owned by not-for-profit Central Indiana Community Foundation. It will be leased to Goodwill of Central and Southern Indiana, which will employ the workers and then act as the supplier of the products.
I'll try to simplify it.
Yeah.
So we're building a building where we're going to manufacture medical devices, Cook's Medical Devices. Goodwill is going to operate it for us because they're the experts in providing wraparound services. They clear up obstacles that people have, like housing or transportation, mental health issues, living stability. They're tremendous at that. We're not great at that as Cook, right? So we know we're not great at that. But Goodwill is amazing at that. So we have them operate that. And for the employees who need it, they're going to have tremendous support. The building is going to be owned by the Indianapolis Foundation so they can put the proceeds back into the community.
Ashley, how great is the need for those kinds of services, the wraparound services that you mentioned?
It's incredibly important that we get that. The need is astronomical, especially in midst of 2020. If it's taught us anything, there is a greater need for those services.
And to have those services like actually connected to a place of employment, I assume is much more convenient. It makes them much more front of mind.
Yes, yes. To have not only the opportunity of something to look forward to, like a job, but to understand that wraparound services will be able to help stabilize an individual. It's allowing some of the underlying, like secondary things that may have kept them from being able to keep a job, now sustainable and retained within a job. So it's going to just provide like quick and very responsive transformation.
Will the residents of the neighborhood be able to also take advantage of these services, the wraparound services, or is it just for folks who work there?
The services are designed around those employees. What I would say is the other thing that Goodwill does better than any organization I've seen is partner with community organizations. So if somebody is an employee and has a problem with their family member, a child who may be struggling in school, they're going to have partnerships in the community to help people. It's just in their DNA. They build this network of support in a community. So yes, it'll be primarily revolve around the employees, but the network of support will be there for the community.
Now, actually, one of the selling points I gather for the project is that it might not just be about the 100 jobs and the 100 employees, but it could have the effect of sparking new opportunity nearby. Do you have a sense of how that would take place or what kinds of opportunity that would be?
That's a great question. To an example where Pete was able to learn firsthand about the means of stabilizing a grocery store. Well, now we have a pipeline of customers in the neighborhood to help that. So it has this ripple effect where it's more than jobs. This is, again, about opportunity to help accelerate economic mobility across our whole community. One common word we keep saying is hope, where we can see that if I now have funds to be able to take care of my house, it's going to have its impact of, hey, maybe if I am working here in the neighborhood, maybe I can look now at opportunities of being that first-time homeowner.
Pete, what is the timeline for constructing the facility and getting it up and running?
Yeah, so I said we like to move quick, so we're moving as quick as we can. Demolition will start on Monday.
What is on the site currently?
So there is an old church that has been long vacant and is not really salvageable. And so we're going to start demolition of that facility. Then we're going to start construction as soon as the demolition is done. We hope to be operational and up and running by the end of 2021. That's our goal. And the interesting thing about this is we're going to need a trained workforce. So we don't want to open the facility and then have to wait for 6 months for a trained workforce. So Goodwill is going to start hiring in January, and they're going to hire people and let them work in their Tremont facility, which is sort of just across town a little bit. They'll provide transportation. They're going to start hiring residents immediately to start that training so that we can be ready to go on day one.
Do I have to have any kind of experience in manufacturing? I mean, would I even need to have graduated from high school to have an opportunity here?
No, that's the great thing. You don't. But what you're going to learn are the skills to work in a really sophisticated medical device manufacturing facility. This facility will be registered with the FDA as a medical device manufacturing location, which means there is heavy expectations of quality, of systems. We're not making cell phones here. We're going to make products that are used to save patients' lives. So it's serious business. The other great thing about this program is You know, at Cook, we're big believers in the combination of a job and education. We think that's the key to helping people have upward mobility. So every employee will have access to a job, but they'll also have access to free education all the way from a high school diploma to a master's degree. We think that the value proposition of coming to work for Cook is hopefully we give you a great job, hopefully you stay forever, but even if you don't and you take advantage of our education system, now we've got a more skilled person, we've got a person who's more committed to the community, they can go out and help make the community better too.
Well, congratulations, guys. That sounds like a really great idea. I hope other companies take you up on the model.
So you can reach out to us at community@cookmedical.com. And we'd love to talk to anybody, anywhere, anytime about this opportunity, because I tell you what, if you spend time in Northeast Indianapolis, you're going to meet some incredible people. These are people who are having success and on what they say is just a prayer for funding. And if you can find people who can have success in that model and you give them some resources, imagine what they could do. So this has been a really fulfilling project and we're excited about it.
Would this be replicable even in a rural setting?
Absolutely. If you look at the issues that are challenging our communities, they're foundational issues. So it's lack of access to education, job opportunities with upward mobility, healthcare, safety. These issues cut across our states where we've seen manufacturing jobs leave. There's no reason this model couldn't work in Paoli, just like it's going to work in Devington or Northeast Indianapolis.
Well, best of luck to you guys. This is super exciting, and I'm glad you've done it.
Yeah, thank you for talking to us. It's been a great opportunity to have that, just to be able to share it. And I hope that people will start to see the community in a different light, because there really is a remarkable community.
My thanks again to Pete Yonkman and Ashley Gervitz. Before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to several strong stories in the latest print edition of IBJ. The coal industry is fighting for its life in Indiana, where production has fallen and employment has thinned in recent years. And it might have powerful friends in the Indiana General Assembly, where Republican lawmakers are preparing to roll out legislation to address stability and reliability on the electrical grid, John Russell reports for us. Also, in this week's issue, Anthony Shetley tracks the progress of startup studio High Alpha, which has hit a higher gear this year by introducing 8 new tech firms, with 2 more expected in December. And Lindsay Erdody explores how the pandemic could exacerbate the challenges of the Salvation Army's Red Kettle campaign, which already faced hurdles such as decreased foot traffic and the decline of people who carry cash. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest business news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information that you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.